Imagine, for just a second, that you're tasked with building this massive, highly secure corporate headquarters. But instead of, pouring concrete or welding steel, your building materials are entirely made of code, like virtual networks and mathematical
Yeah,
algorithms.
you're building a digital fortress.
Exactly. A digital fortress. And welcome to today's deep dive, by the way.
Glad to be here.
Because what's wild is that this digital fortress, built purely on logic, can actually be way more impenetrable than a physical vault.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we aren't just talking about thick firewalls here. We're talking about architecture that mathematically guarantees isolation.
Which is just fascinating. So whether you are, managing a sprawling IT infrastructure for a living, or you're just wildly curious about how the internet's most secure environments are actually engineered, this deep dive is absolutely for you. Today, we are unpacking a really cool stack of architectural blueprints. We're looking at the AWS Well-Architected Framework, their prescriptive guidance, and a real-world enterprise design document that was built for a highly regulated environment.
Yeah, it's a very strict setup.
Right. We want to understand exactly how top-tier organizations build an AWS enterprise landing zone. So I guess let's start with that term.
Landing zone.
Yeah. If we stick with the fortress idea, what exactly are we landing on here?
Well, the landing zone is essentially the surveyed land, right? It's the foundational bedrock that you build everything else upon.
Okay.
In cloud architecture, a landing zone is a well-architected, highly scalable, and secure starting point for deploying your workloads. It's like the pre-configured environment that ensures everything you build later adheres to your strict rules.
Got it. Now, looking through these blueprints, the very first thing that jumps out to me is this concept of a multi-account strategy.
Yes.
And I have to admit, my initial assumption was always that a massive organization just sets up one giant AWS account.
Yeah, like one big sandbox.
Yeah, like one colossal login. Maybe they share the credentials and everyone just logs in to build their servers in that one
I mean,
space.
it's a very common assumption, but doing that at an enterprise scale is just a recipe for absolute disaster.
Really, disaster.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
The core best practice, which is like heavily emphasized in the AWS prescriptive guidance, it centers around isolating resources into multiple AWS accounts.
Okay.
You really have to stop thinking of an account as just a username and password. You need to think of it as a rigid, impenetrable container for resources.
But why is that rigid separation so critical? Because
Yeah.
honestly, it sounds like a total administrative headache to manage hundreds of distinct logins instead of just one.
Well, it solves a few fundamental problems, the biggest one being security and what we call the blast radius.
Blast radius, right.
Yeah. Let's say a bad actor, or even just a nasty piece of malware, somehow compromises a public-facing web server.
Okay, bad news.
Very bad. If that server is in your one giant account, the attacker can potentially move laterally. They might pivot from that web server straight into your highly sensitive customer database.
But with a rigid account boundary.
Exactly. The blast radius is contained.
It stops the fire from spreading from the public lobby to the executive offices.
Precisely. It literally can't jump the gap. And the second reason is billing and cost allocation.
Oh, like tracking who spends what.
Right. An account boundary is really the only true mathematically distinct way to separate line items at a strict billing level.
That makes sense.
And third, limit allocations. AWS places hard limits on how many resources you can spin up per account.
To stop you from spending $1 million by accident?
Exactly, to prevent accidental overprovisioning.
Yeah.
If everything is in one account, a runaway development script could accidentally consume all the network limits, and that brings your actual production applications to a grinding halt.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm visualizing this like zoning a city.
I like that.
You wouldn't put the highly secure bank vaults in the exact same zone as the chaotic public park, right? You build distinct neighborhoods.
That's a great way to look at it. And the blueprints show exactly how these neighborhoods are zoned using what AWS calls organizational units.
OUs.
Right, OUS. These group accounts based on their specific function and their security needs.
So let's break that down a bit. In the design document, they outline an overarching OU just for the platform.
Yeah.
What exactly goes into the platform neighborhood?
So the platform OU is basically the administrative heart of the city. Inside it, they mandate distinct, isolated accounts for network, security, logging, and shared services.
Okay, so they split all the admin stuff up.
Exactly. It enforces a separation of duties.
Give me a real example of that separation.
Sure. Take the networking account. That account holds the transit gateways and the direct connect lines.
Wait, let's pause there. Transit gateways, if we're sticking to the city analogy, what does that translate to?
Think of a transit gateway like the central train station. It connects all these isolated neighborhoods together, but only along strictly approved routes.
Gotcha. And the direct connect lines?
Those are the physical private highways that link this cloud city back to the company's actual on-premises data centers.
Okay, so the networking team manages the train station and the highways.
Right. But the security and logging accounts are completely separate. The people managing the network train station do not have the keys to alter the security logs.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so if a network engineer makes a mistake or even goes rogue, they literally cannot cover their tracks by deleting the audit logs.
Because those logs live in a totally different container.
Exactly. And then outside of that platform OU, they have separate OUs for the actual applications. The production environments, the development testing grounds, the sandbox areas.
So the city is perfectly zoned, the train stations are built, the secure areas are fenced off. But here's the human element, right? Once it's zoned, how do you actually enforce the laws?
Right, that's the tricky part.
Because people make mistakes. A well-meaning developer might accidentally try to build a public park right in the middle of the bank vault zone.
And that is the exact challenge highly regulated environments face.
Yeah.
Especially those handling, you know, sensitive financial or personal data.
Right.
To solve this, they use AWS Control Tower and AWS organizations.
Mm.
And the primary enforcement mechanism is something called an SCP.
A service control policy.
Yes, exactly.
So how does that differ from the regular permissions a user gets? Because normally an IT admin just gives me a login that says, like, what I'm allowed to click on, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you're thinking of IAM policies,
mm.
Identity and access management. Those define what a specific user can do.
Okay.
But an SCP is entirely different. It's applied at the top level, the organization or the OU level,
mm.
and it acts as an absolute ironclad guardrail.
Meaning what exactly?
It dictates the maximum available permissions for all accounts within that organization, regardless of who is logging in.
Hold on. So even if I am the absolute top tier system administrator for my specific account, if the overarching SCP says no, I still can't do it.
Full stop. You cannot do it. It supersedes everything.
Wow.
Yeah. SCPs are not polite suggestions from the IT department.
Yeah.
They are the laws of physics in that cloud environment.
Give me an example from the blueprint.
Sure. They mandate an SCP called Prevent Root Actions. This literally blocks the root user of an account, the most powerful user possible, from taking any action at all.
That is wild. You can't even use the master key.
Nope.
What else do they block?
Well, they use one called Block VPC Internet Access for specific internal environments.
A VPC is a virtual private cloud, right?
Right. Essentially, your private slice of the AWS network. This SCP mathematically prevents any resource inside that VPC from ever being exposed to the public web.
Even by accident?
Even by a determined admin. And perhaps the most critical one is prevent CloudTrail disabling.
Let me guess. CloudTrail is the audit log.
It is the security camera system of AWS. It records every single API call and action taken.
So that SCP makes it technically impossible for anyone to turn off the security cameras. You can't disable the logging.
Precisely. The cameras are always rolling.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Go for it.
If we lock things down this tightly, where I can't use a root account, I can't touch the internet, everything is constantly recorded, doesn't this completely strangle innovation?
It sounds like it would, yeah.
Right. If I'm a developer, that sounds incredibly frustrating. I'd have to submit a ticket and wait 3 weeks just to test a new piece of code. How does any actual work get done?
It's a very fair concern, and it highlights a classic tension in enterprise IT, security versus agility.
Right.
But what's fascinating here is how the philosophy of guardrails actually flips that dynamic.
Mm.
If an organization relies on human review for every single action, like a traditional gatekeeper approach, then yes, innovation slows to a crawl.
Because humans are slow.
Exactly.
Mm.
But SCPs act as guardrails on a highway.
Meaning you can drive as fast as you want as long as you don't crash through the barrier.
Exactly. Because the company uses automated services like AWS Config to continuously track compliance and SCPs to define the absolute outer boundaries, development teams actually have more freedom.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a developer doesn't have to wait weeks for a security review to spin up a new server in the sandbox environment. They could just do it.
Because the system won't let them break the big rules anyway.
Right. They have autonomy because they know, and the security team knows, that the automated system simply will not let them accidentally expose that server to the internet. They experiment, rapidly and safely within hard-coded boundaries.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. The automation actually enables the freedom.
Exactly.
So we have secure borders, the internal rules are hard-coded, the blast radius is minimized. But let's talk about the actual treasure inside this fortress, the data itself.
Yes, the most important part.
How does an enterprise protect its most sensitive information in this setup?
Well, data protection is a core pillar of the AWS well-architected framework. You have to protect data in transit as it moves across the network, and data at rest when it's just sitting on a storage drive.
Now, in the blueprints, I noticed they split their approach. For their non-productive environments, like development or testing, they use something called AMS, AWS Key Management Service.
Yes. And specifically, they use customer master keys, or CMKs, within that service.
How does that work, you know, in plain English?
With a CMK in KMS, your organization generates and manages the policies for the encryption keys. But the keys themselves physically reside within AWS's highly secure hardware.
Okay.
AWS handles all the heavy lifting of the complex cryptographic math. It's highly secure, incredibly efficient, and perfectly fine for the vast majority of workloads.
But here is where I see a potential problem.
Let's hear it.
If I'm storing my most critical, highly regulated data in AWS, and AWS also holds the encryption keys to that data, doesn't that mean AWS technically has access to the vault? I mean, they have the lock and the key in the exact same building.
You've just hit on the exact reason why. For their production environment, they abandon that standard approach.
Really?
Yeah. The blueprint reveals a much more extreme security measure to solve the exact problem you just described. They use XKS.
XKS? What does that stand for?
External Key Store. This is where we see the absolute highest echelon of cloud security.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
With an external key store, the cryptographic keys used to encrypt the data never live in the cloud. They never touch AWS infrastructure.
Wait. If the data is sitting in an AWS data center, but the keys aren't, how do you unlock the data?
The keys reside physically on premises.
Like in the company's own building.
Exactly. They sit in the organization's physical data centers, locked inside specialized tamper-proof devices called hardware security modules, HSMs.
Okay.
The blueprint specifically mentions utilizing Thales CipherTrust appliances. These physical boxes are then connected to the AWS cloud via that dedicated private high-speed fiber optic line we mentioned earlier, the Direct Connect.
Okay, let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. It's like you're renting an impenetrable state-of-the-art safe deposit box from AWS to hold your data.
Right.
But you refuse to let them hold a copy of the key. The only physical key stays in your pocket, in your own building, across the country.
Yes.
So every time AWS needs to put something in the box or read something from it, it has to essentially call you over this private fiber optic line and ask the key in your pocket to unlock it.
That is an incredibly accurate way to describe it. AWS sends the encryption or decryption request over the Direct Connect line to your on-premises HSM.
And then the HSM does the work.
Exactly. The HSM performs the mathematical operation locally, securely inside its own hardware, and just sends the scrambled or unscrambled result back to AWS. The key itself never leaves your physical building.
That is fascinating. But what happens if that private fiber optic line is cut? Like a backhoe digs up the street and severs the Direct Connect? Or what if the company suspects a breach and decides to literally pull the plug on their own HSM servers?
If that happens, the data sitting in the AWS cloud instantly becomes mathematically unreadable.
Just instantly locked.
It is just random noise. Even if a highly sophisticated attacker somehow breached the AWS physical data center and walked out with the hard drives under their arm, they couldn't read the data.
Because the keys literally aren't there.
Right. The keys to decrypt it do not exist in that facility. It provides what we call ultimate cryptographic sovereignty.
Ultimate cryptographic sovereignty. It sounds like something out of a spy novel.
It really does.
But stepping back for a second, managing physical keys off-site, dealing with hundreds of separated AWS accounts, thousands of service control policies, complex network routing, how does human error not destroy this?
Oh, it absolutely would.
Right. If an IT guy makes a typo configuring one firewall rule, doesn't the whole system just go down?
Yes. And if we connect this to the broader philosophy of the AWS well-architected framework, we are now entering the operational excellence pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, humans clicking around in a web console, manually configuring firewalls and spinning up accounts, that is a massive, unacceptable risk at this scale.
Right, because humans get tired. We forget a checkbox. We mistype an IP address.
Exactly. Manual configuration doesn't scale, it isn't easily repeatable, and it inevitably introduces catastrophic human error.
Which brings me to what I want to call the engine room of this whole operation, how they actually build and maintain the fortress.
Yeah, the automation piece.
Let's talk about the historical context for a second. 10, 15 years ago, if a company needed a new server environment, what did that actually look like?
Oh, it was a months-long ordeal. You had to order physical hardware.
Right, wait for it to ship.
Exactly. It would arrive on a loading dock, technicians would unbox it, physically rack it in a server room, run power cables, run network cables, install the operating system from a disk or a drive, and manually configure every single security setting.
And today, in this blueprint, none of that happens.
None of it. Everything we have discussed so far, the accounts, the network routes, the SCP, the encryption configurations, it is not built by physically racking servers, and it isn't even built by clicking buttons on a screen.
And how is it built?
It is written as text files. It's deployed entirely as code using a tool called HashiCorp Terraform.
Infrastructure as code, IAC.
Yeah,
it really is a mind-bending concept if you stop to think about it. You are literally writing software that creates hardware. Well, virtual hardware.
And the blueprint details a very sophisticated GitOps flow for managing this. Specifically, they use a solution called Account Factory for Terraform, or AFT.
I really want to unpack this process because when I read through this section of the design document, it sounded like a digital Rube Goldberg machine.
It kind of is.
But obviously, there's a profound logic to it. So let's say a development team needs a brand new, fully secure, highly regulated AWS account for a new project. Walk me through what actually happens.
Sure. Step one. A developer writes a few lines of configuration code requesting the account. They push that code to a self-managed GitLab repository.
Okay, notice they aren't logging into AWS at all.
Exactly. They are just committing text to a version control system, the exact same way they would save a software update.
Okay, so saving that text file is the first domino. What's next?
That code push automatically triggers a CI/CD pipeline, continuous integration, and continuous deployment. They use a tool like Jenkins for this.
Okay.
The pipeline takes that request and logs it into an Amazon DynamoDB database.
Wait, why a database? Why doesn't it just build the account right then and there?
Because the database acts as the official, immutable ledger of the request. It tracks exactly who asked for what and exactly when.
For the audit trail.
Right. The moment that database entry is created, an EventBridge trigger fires off. You can think of EventBridge as the central nervous system of AWS.
Okay, so EventBridge notices the database changed.
Yep. It detects the change and immediately triggers a Lambda function.
Now, Lambda is serverless compute, right? Just a little block of code that wakes up, does a specific job, and goes back to sleep so you aren't paying for it to run 24/7.
Exactly. It's incredibly efficient. This first Lambda function formats the request and sends a message to an SQS queue, a simple queue service.
Again, why the extra step? Why put it in a queue?
This is a crucial concept in architecture called decoupling. The queue acts as a buffer.
Like a waiting room.
Exactly. Imagine if a developer accidentally wrote a script that requested 5,000 new accounts all at exactly the same second.
Oh, that would break things.
Yeah, if the system tried to build them all simultaneously, it would completely crash.
Yeah.
The SQS queue lines them all up neatly, processing them sequentially so the system never gets overwhelmed.
That's smart.
And finally, a second Lambda function reads the request from that queue and commands AWS Control Tower to actually provision and build the account.
Wow. Okay, so what does this fundamental shift mean for the humans actually working in IT operations? I mean, they aren't plugging in cables and they aren't even configuring virtual servers manually. What are they doing all day?
They're operating at a much higher level of abstraction. They are essentially writing the code that builds the factory that builds the servers.
Mind-blowing.
By relying on version control and these automated pipelines, we achieve what's called immutable infrastructure.
Meaning it can't be changed once it's built.
Correct. If a piece of infrastructure breaks or, you know, gets compromised, you do not log into it and try to manually patch the problem.
You don't try to fix the broken server.
Never. You fix the text code in GitLab, and you let the automated pipeline completely tear down the broken environment and build a fresh, perfect one in its place.
Wow.
This practice of making frequent, small, automated, and reversible changes is the absolute core of operational excellence.
Because the entire history of your data center is now just a text document. You can literally read the history of your infrastructure like a book. You know exactly who changed what, when they changed it, and why.
Exactly. It removes the guesswork and drastically minimizes the risk of human error.
It is incredibly elegant. We started this deep dive with the metaphor of a digital fortress. And looking back at the journey we just took, we started by mapping out the raw land with a multi-account landing zone.
Right.
Making sure we separated the bank vaults from the public parks to contain the blast radius.
We then established the absolute unbreakable laws of the land using service control policies. We put up those guardrails to ensure that no one can accidentally or maliciously compromise those borders or turn off the security cameras.
Then we locked down the most critical data using external key stores, keeping the physical cryptographic keys completely off-site. The cloud only ever holds locked boxes, never the keys themselves.
And finally, we automated the entire construction process. Using infrastructure as a code, Terraform, and that decoupled CI/CD pipeline, the environment basically builds and rebuilds itself consistently, securely, and without manual human intervention.
So to bring it all home, why should you, the listener, care about all this? Maybe you don't run a multinational financial institution. Maybe you're running a small tech startup or managing a mid-sized e-commerce platform.
You should care because these principles are rapidly becoming the baseline for digital survival.
Baseline, not a luxury.
Right. Whether you are managing a massive enterprise or launching a lean startup, the concepts of resource isolation, least privilege access, and infrastructure automation are no longer just nice to have. They are the required bedrock.
Absolutely.
If you understand how a landing zone works, you understand the language of modern cloud architecture. You understand how to scale up your business without your costs spiraling out of control, and how to innovate incredibly fast without leaving your front door wide open to attackers.
It really is a masterclass in modern system design. But it leaves me with one final, somewhat wild thought.
Let's hear it.
If our entire infrastructure, the networks, the firewalls, the databases, is now essentially just lines of text sitting in a Git repository, and we have automated services like AWS Config constantly monitoring the environment to ensure that reality matches that code.
Yeah.
How far are we from a future where cloud architectures don't just heal themselves, but actually design themselves?
Oh, man, that is a very provocative thought.
Right.
With the rapid evolution of generative AI, the idea of an architecture analyzing its own traffic patterns, identifying a bottleneck, and autonomously writing the Terraform code to restructure itself. I mean, it is really not as far off as we might assume.
An infrastructure that adapts, learns, and evolves entirely on its own. Now, that is a true digital fortress, something to definitely think about as you look at your own systems today. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the blueprint of the ultimate enterprise cloud. Keep exploring, keep questioning the systems around you, and take care.